Good morning.
Good morning.
Hi. So this morning I'm going to talk about dreams and wakefulness. Wakefulness and dreams. So I'm going to start with a story from a 9th century in China. Just this short interchange between Nanchuan, Nansen, Nanchuan, and his student who has just had an awakening. The student says, "Heaven, earth, and I have the same root. Myriad things and I are one body. Isn't this marvelous?" Nanchuan replies, "People these days see this flower as a dream, or as in a dream." So, how do we awaken? How do we wake up? This is a lot of what Zen practice is about. How do we awaken? How do we wake up? Zen practice itself sometimes can be just another dream. Just another dream. Perpetuating the illusion that I'm independent from you guys. That I am my own man. And you guys are secondary, or tertiary, or quadrary, or whatever. Perpetuating that illusion through my Zen practice, right? Through any practice. Any practice. Zazen to accomplish something. Accomplish something. To get calm. To change who I am. And then I just perpetuate my craving. I perpetuate my not being okay about myself, right? And I've been talking for years about, well, it's much more important just to show up, just to do the practice over and over again. Just do it. Just do it. Just do it. Even if you're not doing it well, if you're doing it well, if you're doing it okay, sometimes just do it. Just do it. But actually, that's not quite enough. It's not quite enough. Because if we don't engage with our whole being, with the entire body and mind, then we can just dream in on our cushions for the rest of our lives. Daydream, night dream, self-hypnotic dream, hypnagogic dream. Oh boy, you got the whole wall there to dream. Right? Not quite enough. Wholehearted, right? Wholehearted. We want to wake up. Xiao Yuan Wu comments on this interchange, as these guys do, as these guys did and still do. He comments saying, "Nanchuan pointed at a flower in the garden and called to the student saying, 'People these days see this flower as though it were a dream. This is like leading a man to the edge of a 10,000 fathom cliff and giving him a push, causing his life to be cut off. If you were pushed over on level ground, you would simply be unable to cut off life.'" So, to wake up from this self-constructed way of being, this self-constructed sort of, it's kind of a prison that we've constructed. It's got windows in it. But it's kind of a prison, isn't it? To wake up from this self-constructed prison, we have to move to the edge of a cliff. Sorry. Sorry. We have to move to the edge of a cliff. It doesn't do any good to push someone over on level ground. They don't go anywhere. We have to go to the edge of our self-construction. We have to go to the edge of it. Because within our self-construction, within that desire to accomplish, the desire to be good, the desire to do what you should do, we're still caught. We're still caught. So we have to go to the edge of the cliff, the edge of the self-construction. And that's where the place of possibility is. That's where the place of deep inquiry is. That's where the place of wonder is. And ultimately, great joy, great peace. Great peace. But not within the self-construction. That's why we say Zen practice has an arduous side. It has an arduous side to it. But it's not ardor that has to be some discipline we force on ourselves. It's the ardor that comes from our ardent heart. Ardor is about the heart. It's not about some discipline to be a good boy or be a this or that or the other or live up to this or that or the other. It's ardor from your heart. Your heart mind, the center of all life. Okay? So Yan Wu continues commenting on this. He says, it's also like a person in a dream. Though you want to awaken, you cannot wake up. Called by another, you awaken. Someone beyond your self-construction, beyond the echo of your own voice, is calling you to open up to the ardor of your heart, which is not separate, which is connected with everything. You're being called. This is our tradition. We say lineage, but we don't even care about lineage. It's teacher, student, friend, 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 generation after generation. Calling. I'm calling you. I'm calling you to open your heart. To what? You don't know. We don't know. If you know, that's not opening your heart, is it? That's your preconception, that's your self-construction. Yanwu said, it is also like a person in a dream. No, you want to awaken, you cannot wake up. Called by another, you awaken. And when we're dreaming, what happens? We see, we hear, we feel, we react. And then we wake up and we realize that our mind was creating that dream. Our mind was creating that dream. While we're in the dream, we believe that's all there is. And suddenly there's a subtle shift. Suddenly there's a subtle shift. And the dream disappears. It's gone. It's gone. Where'd it go? Was it just an illusion? It certainly seemed real, didn't it? On the other hand, Dogen says, teaching the dream state in the dream state is the realm of Buddhist ancestors and is the order of Buddhist ancestors. It's the order of the ancestors. The Buddha's realm, the Buddha's order, the ancestors' truth, and the ancestors' order are experience on the basis of experience and are preaching of the dream state in the dream state. So, what's he saying here? Well, I don't know exactly, but who knows exactly? But he seems to be saying what I've said before, what my teacher said. Imagining and dreaming who we want to be is pretty important. Creating a mental model of who we want to be is pretty important. We become what attracts us. Dreaming and then incorporating those attractive qualities of our dream into our way of life means that we can become who we dream we are. We can become who we dream we are. We align ourselves with what we think is important, what we feel is important, what we dream to be important. We become a writer by writing, not by talking about writing, not by thinking about writing, not by figuring out how to make a living by writing. We become a writer by writing. We become a dancer by dancing. That's how we do it. Because we have that dream. We have that dream. It can be a dim vision. Dim dream is fine. Dogen always talks about dim visions. Cataracts. The dreams with cataracts is what Dogen talks about, although they didn't know about cataracts back then. But the vision can be very dim. It's still the dream. You activate it, you live it. We make it real by living it, and it becomes, we see ourselves becoming it. We kind of become it. So, two examples here. Actually, I got lots of examples, but I only have so much time. First example is a kind of romantic example, but I'll be romantic for a moment. Jennifer Lawrence. That's a romantic example. For me, at least. maybe not for some of you. She's 14 years old, right? She wants to act. She has a dream of acting. Her parents are not into this at all. But they love her. She wants to act. She figures out how to coerce her mom and to take her to New York for the summer when she's 14. Where there's theater, well, there's acting. And then while she's there, she hangs out as much as she can at theater with actors, and a photographer finds her, and it gives her a lot of encouragement. She goes back to the Midwest with her family. She does her 4 years of high school in 2 years because she wants to act. She can't act in high school. She gets a 3.9 in high school during those 2 years. She coerces her family gently and lovingly, because that's the only way you can coerce family. Take her out to L.A. after she graduates from high school. They all move out to L.A., right? They all think it's crazy, but you know, dreams are crazy. Dreams are crazy. And, you know, you guys know the rest of the story. I first became aware of her when I saw Winter's Bone. What was that, 3 years ago? She auditioned for Winter's Bone. She was 19. And she had to uglify herself for that. She saw that. She talked about how she didn't wash her hair. I mean, she just put her whole self into it. Oh, to audition for it, she had to uglify herself. So, there's Jennifer Lawrence. And here she is now. And there's my friend Paul. My friend Paul, who I first knew at the Zen Center here, and that's not his real name, years ago, when he was 14, he wanted to be a poet. So he started writing poetry. Every day he wrote poetry. Every day he listened and he wrote. He didn't talk about poetry. He never talked about his poetry. He wrote it. He wrote it. He was very quiet. And now he's 65. Nobody knows him. He's had to support himself selling insurance and doing dishes. He's a poet. He dreamed of being a poet. His poetry is beautiful. He self-published a little things. A few people have read them. Nobody's read them. Well, maybe after he's dead, somebody will read his poetry. Maybe it'll be a Van Gogh, you know. 50 years after his death, everybody will discover it. But if you give yourself to something with your heart, that's the whole deal. Everything else is extra. He gives himself to his poetry with his heart. That's the whole deal. Everything is extra. You know that? You know that, don't you? You know this, don't you? So in Buddhist practice, we dream within the dream of separateness. Tim here. there is a dream of waking up. So the dream within the dream. Within the dream of separateness, there is a dream of waking up. Right? Right? That's interesting. That's interesting. So, when I met my first teacher, Suzuki, Roshi, I had just read about Buddha's life. That was the most recent book I'd read. It was about Buddha's life and about his four encounters. Encounter with the, at the beginning, you know, before he entered the path. His encounters with whom? With the sick person who was sores all over his body, was in great agony. Of the person who was decrepit and aged and not able to stand straight and almost crawling on the ground. And you can read the different accounts. You know, they embellish it. The Pali Sutras are pretty clean. I mean, they don't have a lot of embellishment, but everybody else embellished it later, right? And then he encountered the, what did he encounter after that? The funeral pyre with all the bodies burning, right? But his fourth encounter, well, so if he'd just done the first three encounters, what would the deal be here? He would have just gone off with Sartre and Camus, hung out in the coffee houses of Paris, had been an existentialist. But he had a fourth encounter. Had a fourth encounter, right? And that was, he saw someone who really seemed to be manifesting stillness, just in their being. He just saw this person pass by him. Some lightness, some stillness, some openness. And that became his dream. I want that. I will become that. I will manifest that. And so he did it, right? So when I met my teacher, I just read about about the fourth. I had spent a lot of time on the first three because I did Sartre and Camus when I was in college. And I slept through all my classes and I drank lots of alcohol and I never smoked like they did, but I read them. That's absurdity of existence. Existence is absurd. I absorbed that. It's irrational. We're irrational. All this religious stuff is all bullshit, right? All bullshit. I did the three. But then when I saw my teacher, I saw the possibility of waking up in his eyes. I saw it in his eyes. And you could say it's mystical or something. I don't know. I don't care, mystical or not mystical. He had a lightness to him. He had a simplicity to him. And I saw that possibility. That became my dream. It was an impossibility. Because I couldn't even sit still for 2 minutes. Because I slept till noon every day. It was impossible. Well, who cares? Who cares? It's possible. It's possible. If you dream of it, it's possible. And I went home and told my father. And my father said, "Boy, you have a very unrealistic dream." He said, "A lot of people think there's some abiding calmness in the world. But that's just all delusion. That's all delusion." But I didn't believe him. I didn't believe him. If I believed him, I would have gone back to the cafes in San Francisco, which I was tired of. I didn't even like coffee. And the cigarette smoke in those cafes. When I first started Zen practice in San Francisco, I would stay up all night, since my sleeping was all messed up, right? I would stay up all night in those cafes and wait for Zazen to begin at 5:30 in the morning. Because it was warm in there and I liked the ambiance to a degree. I did like it to a degree. So now I want to talk about one of my favorite dream stories, or just a tiny little story, which I've talked about lots of times before, but not recently, from Chuang Tzu, the Taoist, pre-Zen Taoist teacher. Once Chuang Tzu dreamt he was a butterfly, flitting and fluttering around, happy with himself and doing as he pleased. He didn't know he was Chuang Tzu. Suddenly he woke up and there he was, solid and unmistakably Chuang Tzu. But he didn't know if he was Chuang Tzu who had dreamt he was a butterfly, or a butterfly dreaming he was Chuang Tzu. Between Chuang Tzu and a butterfly, there must be some distinction. This is called the transformation of things. There'd be no Zen without Chuang Tzu. Really, there wouldn't be any. That's a whole other talk, right? So what are some of the teachings in that little vignette? Well, I've been talking about some of them, right? The first is awakening from the dream of separateness, of isolation, of alienation, through practice. Our everyday consciousness is kind of like sleep. And the things that we think about really don't have any more reality than a dream. We operate at a pretty low level a lot of the time. We walk into a room, we don't remember why we even walked into the room. We go through the motions and day to day, kind of sleepwalk through our lives. And then we have a moment of clarity. The alarm clock sounds and we wake up. And we go back to sleep. Those few moments of clarity in our day, in our life. But we can, through practice, more and more, we can have those moments of clarity be the center of our being, not be just something like we wake up and then go right back to sleep. That's the promise. That's the promise of the dream. That's the promise of awakening. And to do that, we have to notice it's our habitual tendency to clump together into one tangled mass, one tangled mess. All of our perceptions, all of our naming, all of our thinking, and all of our planning. And when I talk about this, I talk about the skandhas, the aggregates, but I'm going to even simplify it more today and say that it's a three-step process. And don't analyze this too much. It's a three-step process, right? We perceive an object, we assign a name to an object, and then we spin off into concepts, thoughts, and feelings about the object. I see you, and I name you as Jeff, and then I spin off about all my memories and interactions, fun and not fun, to be and in the past and present and future about you, right? That's what we do. Problem is that we barely notice that perception. We spend most of our time in a spun-off state. So if we do the practice of bringing into view the three-part process, that's good. We can do that. Then we can possibly perceive something as if it were for the first time. And of course it is for the first time. Really, when I'm looking at you right now, it's the first time that we've ever been here like this together. It's the first time. Even though you always sit close, sometimes you sit there, sometimes you sit there. This is the first time. So, we can, through our practice, begin. So, I can perceive this, right? I just perceive it as it is. And then I name it a microphone. And then I have all kinds of thoughts about how I'm going to use it and whether it's loud enough and whether it's soft enough and whether I'm projecting enough. And although maybe I ignore it entirely. But in my immediate perception, boy, I can notice it. protection. Wow. Feel it. And then the smoothness. Wow. What if I turn it upside down? I can poke you. Maybe I can use it as my kisaku. Wow. My immediate perception. Before I name it. Before I conceptualize it. Before I compare it. Before I contrast it. My teacher calls that beginner's mind, right? Beginner's mind. But beginner's mind doesn't think it's a beginner's mind. It's just aware. It's not caught at all the other stuff. It's just aware. And then the stuff comes up. We name it as a mic. It has a use. That stuff is all great. But what about the beginning? Or what about always coming back to the beginning and just enjoying the beginning? We're always at the beginning. We can always enjoy it, as painful as it may be, as upside down or inside out as it may be. Beginner's mind, right? Mind. Beginner's mind. They say in Buddhist thought, early Buddhist thought, that a perception is about the time of a kasana. And a kasana is like that. So there's a perception that's a kasana, and then there's a naming the perception, which is also a kasana. Oh no, actually, naming the and thinking about the perception. Thinking, I thought about the perception is 60 kasanas. Actually, I'm getting this all wrong. But you get the point. I think actually a finger snap is 60 kasanas, 60 moments. And a thought is, oh, this is right. This is 60 moments, and a thought is 90 moments. So anyway, the point is, we have the availability of something always immediate here for us to tap into. It's always available. And if we're aware of our habitual tendency to clamp down through our thinking, we can open up and make some very surprising discoveries about the world in front of us. And that's awakening from our feelings of separateness and isolation that we carry around with us all the time. But we don't need to do it all the time. We don't need to do it much of the time. I guess we all do it a little bit of the time. And actually, we all need to do a little bit of that time. Because we need to plan. We need to strategize. We need to be political. I need to be very political in certain aspects of my life. I won't get into that. But we have a reason to need to be political. But what about the immediate? What about the immediate? Immediately being joined to everything that precedes that, that is the antecedent. So that's the first teaching in this vignette by Chuangzi. Second teaching is, dream is like life, life is like a dream. Dream is like life, life is like a dream. Sights and sounds, feelings and emotions in the dream can be just as vivid and intense as they are in real life, right? That's what we're talking about. That's what we're talking about. But at the same time, we can also work the other way. We can realize that our obsessions, that our worries, that our fears are very similar to a dream, aren't they? They're very similar to dream. And we can actually regain our tranquility when we remember. When we remember this. When we remember Chuangzi. Remember Chuangzi. For instance, let's say Laura has stood me up. Laura is sitting here across from me. Let's say she stood me up for Doksan, which is a private, sacred interview with me up in my secret quarters. She stood me up three times in a row. And here she is, having the the effrontery to be sitting looking at me and smiling as I'm talking. Never having apologized. Not once having apologized. So I'm angry. I'm angry. I feel hurt, offended. But what if it was just a dream? What if it was just a dream that I'm waking up from? I would just shrug it off, wouldn't I? I'd just say, well, it's just a dream. It's over. It's over. Can you do that? Can you do that? Sure. Why not? Why not? It takes some reminding. And it also takes some practice. Some practice. It's a reminding. So we can manage our negative emotions. They're results of nightmares. They're results of daymares. Just wake up from the daymare. Wake up from the nightmare. Come back to this. Come back to this. To this beginner's problem right here. That's all. Always available, right? Always available. So the third teaching from Chuangzi is transformation into a butterfly. It's not transformation into a worm or a spider. It's transformation into a butterfly. Well, what does a butterfly connote? It connotes freedom, doesn't it? Connotes lightness, doesn't it? Connotes beauty, doesn't it? Freedom, lightness, beauty. Unboundedness. We bind ourselves up, but we're unbounded by nature. That's our Buddha nature. It's unbounded. Right? Doesn't mean it's not painful. It's just unbounded. Not held back by emotional or material obsessions that tie most people down most of the time. So, and I've talked about this lots of times before too, the dream was what? The caterpillar was what? The butterfly was what? The butterfly was a caterpillar, right? The butterfly was a caterpillar. And through his caterpillary patience, diligence, and faith, he ate lots of nutritious leaves, regulated his life, didn't go out too late at night, so that he could prepare to enter the chrysalis. If you want to enter the chrysalis of practice, you have to steady your life. Steady your life. Eat the right food. Get a sufficient amount of exercise. Take care of your alcohol. And take care of your emotions. Don't carry these nightmares around with you all the time. When they're just dreams, then you're ready to enter the chrysalis. We have a chrysalis here all the time. We have this is a chrysalis sendo, right? Sit here for 40 minutes in the chrysalis, 20 minutes in the chrysalis, a day in the chrysalis, a week in the chrysalis. And at some point, the butterfly just flies out. But don't poke your head into it looking for it to happen. Then you have to stay in the chrysalis forever. Really enter the chrysalis, completely enter the chrysalis, without looking for any light. That's the only way that you produce your beautiful butterfly. Your beautiful butterfly, which is your nature. Your nature. How colorful. How light. And it helps people. Your butterflyness helps people just by its flying, at its lighting, gently on your nose, on your shoulder, then flying around you. It helps you. And that freedom is not a dream. It's not a dream. And so the last teaching, the fourth teaching, in this, I don't think I'll read it again, is interpenetration. Interpenetration, right? So remember what Nan Chuan's student said Heaven and earth and I have the same root. Myriad things and I are one body. Isn't this marvelous? Yes, it is marvelous. When everything is realized as our own body and mind, then everything is the body of being, and everything is A-okay. Whether we're sick, whether we're well, whether we're happy, whether we're sad, everything is A-okay. The Gnostic Gospel says, in the Gnostic Gospel it says, "For I am the first and the last. I am the honored one and the scorned one. I am the whore and the holy one. I am the wife and the virgin. I am the barren one, and many are her sons. I am the silence that is incomprehensible. I am the utterance of my name." So, to realize that this frail little body is the body of the universe, wow, that this frail little body that's getting shorter year by year. I used to be 5'6½, and I won't even tell you how short I am now. It's embarrassing. It was embarrassing to be 5'6½. It's doubly embarrassing to tell you how short I've gotten. How short do you think I'll be in another 10 years? This is the body of the universe. This body. This body that's getting a big tummy. It's the tummy of the universe. It should lighten up, shouldn't it? Not eat so much food. This mind, this screwed up mind, this mind that never really got calm, doesn't know anything about calmness, and sits down preaching about everybody should be calm, but is off thinking about the legislature and about its next talk. This is the mind of the universe. This is the universal mind. This is the big mind. This is the mind that includes everything. Is it possible? Is it just a dream? Or is it possible? Interpenetration. Interpenetration. Is it a butterfly? Is it my dreaming heart? Is it a moth? Is it a pain in my toe? Interpenetration. Interpenetration and transformation of all things. Everything transforming. Everything transformed. So, Basho's poem, which he wrote, what would that be? 2,600 years after this? No, not 2,600 years. He wrote his poem in the 18th century, and Chuang-tzu's in the 4th century before the contemporary era. So you can add it up. Anyway, a long time before, right? Long time before. So Basho wrote his friend, and he said, "You are the butterfly, and I am the dreaming heart of Chuang-tzu. You are the butterfly, and I am the dreaming heart of Chuang-tzu. You. I am the butterfly, and you are the dreaming heart of Chuang-tzu. Is it two? Is it one? Is it three? Who's bad and who's good? You are the butterfly, and I'm the dreaming heart of Chuang-tzu." For Robert Aitken, who was one of my favorite teachers, personalization is so much more important than any kind of experience of waking up. Personalization. And when you look at the sordid stories that we've been hearing about religious leaders, Zen leaders, Catholic leaders, Tibetan leaders. It makes me feel sad. It makes my heart ache. But remember, this is about personalization. This is about you and me, you and me, you and me. This is not about some experience. If it's about some experience, it's not interpenetration. It's my experience. I've got the experience, and maybe you can have it if you hang out with me long enough. But you've really got to hang out with me. That's not what this is about. This is about interpenetration. Sometimes I'm the weak one, sometimes you're the strong one. when we trade places, there's everything. Water flows sometimes very fast downstream. Sometimes it just settles in. Which part of the water are we? Which of the drops are we? Well, right now we're the flowing down fast, and then later we'll be the water that's just stagnating. We'll just be stagnating for a while. Well, you can be stagnating water. It's the same water. Just stagnate. It's the water of life. It's the water of being. Nothing stagnates. That's just your fantasy. Oh, that's your fantasy. That's your dream. Good. Dream that you're a stagnating body of water. Stagnating body of water will bring lots of things to it because they'll be impressed by its odor or something. Or something. So I want to finish with another comment by Dogen about dreaming. The dream state is just the clear 100 things. And it is the very moment at which we doubt that it is so. It is the very moment of our confusion. At this moment, it is to dream things. It is to be in things. It is to teach things. And so on, and so on, and so on. So that's what I'd like to say for today, I guess. I guess that's what I'd like to say. So what would you like to say? Would you like to say? Oh, Jeff.
I saw a performance last night called The Dialogue of the Roots, although the title was Portuguese, because, in fact, the people involved, one of them was a Brazilian dancer, and the other was an American guy, but his family background was Irish and Brazilian. Mm-hmm. And so they put together, and he was the musician, and they put together this solo dance and musical performance, and a lot of it went back to the African roots of both of these folks. And then there was a discussion afterwards. And Timothy, who was the musician, was pointing out or expressing his own past, which was, although his family background was Irish and Brazilian, in the U.S., everybody saw him as a black American, so he was raised in that culture. Mm-hmm. A lot of their conversation involved trying to tap back into their family cultures and find some way of unifying them. And as they were talking, I was realizing that, well, we all have these family cultures that we grew up in. Timothy, the musician, his mother was a classical musician, a pianist, for instance. And these family cultures, they tend to divide us and to separate us. Mm-hmm. Look at the rest of the world.
Yeah.
See things from that perspective. Mm-hmm. Well, it occurred to me during this conversation that, only exaggerating slightly, just a few generations ago, we were all African, and that my home is Africa, just as it's the home of all of us. Where is this Africa?
Thank you. Thank you. Where is it? Where is it? Where is it? The question, where, what? This is a way to slow the mind down. You slow the mind down. Like I see this, and before I start talking about it, I say, what? What is this? What is this? And that what, it brings my awareness of the whole thing. If I don't slow my mind down by asking what, then I don't appreciate its wonder. So what is Africa? What is it? What is it? Good. Good. Yeah.
What really differentiates meditation from self-hypnosis?
Oh, that's a good question. Well, I should be able to answer that question because I'm, you know, but maybe I won't be able to, but I should be able to because I'm a psychologist and I used to teach self-hypnosis, so I better be able to answer it. Ooh. Let's see. What differentiates meditation from self-hypnosis? Well, in self-hypnosis, for one thing, we're trying to accomplish something. And in meditation, in a way, we're trying to accomplish something, but really all we're trying to accomplish in meditation is sitting still and watching the mind. Whereas in self-hypnosis, we're trying to accomplish something specific and something particular. And in meditation, we can go often into self-hypnotic trances, self-hypnotic trances, where we're really kind of mesmerized by something. I'm mesmerized by this, by the feeling of this microphone, by the space in this microphone, so that but that's fine. But if that mesmerization doesn't broaden up out into my entire meditation, my entire life, it's just self-hypnosis. So by my bare awareness, I need to find to become one-pointed on this. As I become one-pointed, I can actually be hypnotized by it. But it's the broadening out to personalize, to include you, that comes from the bare awareness. So self-hypnosis can be a good entree into meditation, and you can use it specifically for issues that you have in your life. That's good too. Doesn't necessarily help you open up to big mind. It can. It doesn't have to. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Oh, I answered that okay. Did I answer that okay? Huh? Okay.
Maybe here's another question. Personalization. I'm not really sure.
Personalization. Well, you know, what I hearken back to when you ask me that is my acid-taking days. Then you raise your hands if you know what acid is. Some of you don't even know what it is. No, younger people don't necessarily know what it is. or is that right? Do they know? Am I so old I don't realize that how much they know? Well, I see, I'm out of it. So when I started my practice in San Francisco and Palo Alto in the 60s, everybody was taking acid. Everybody in my culture, you know, because I was in the counterculture. And the counterculture was where you did only practice Zen if you were in the counterculture. You only took acid if you were in the counterculture, right? So my teacher called this. So what's your, what was the question? I forgot. Oh, yeah, personalization. So Suzuki Roshi called, my teacher called taking acid dry enlightenment. So you have some great experience, and then you go home, and when you come down, you're nasty to your wife. That's dry enlightenment. We only care about personalization. We don't care about the experience. We only care about how we are with each other. How we are with each other is a manifestation of how we are with ourselves and with all life. We only care about personalization. We don't care about realization. Realization is some... Maybe we do care about realization. Yes, you probably do. Everybody does. They're not supposed to, but they do. In Soto Zen, you're not supposed to. In Rinzai Zen, it's great. We care about realization, but more important is personalization. Because acid trip after acid trip, even if they're in religious contexts, I only took acid in a religious context. That is, I would never go to a rock concert when I did it. Only in a religious. So you'd have a beautiful experience. You'd open up to everything. You feel one with all life. And then you'd come down and you'd go into the post office where I worked, in the basement of the post office, and piss and moan. Everybody pissed and moaned together. I don't know. What's that? This is about personalization. Does that make sense? Yeah. Anything else? Sure.
Well, I reacted to I like personalization, but what if you're running into and you said to Laura, you didn't apologize to me over...
That's not the personalization of the Dharma. I'm talking about personalization of Dharma. I'm talking about personalization of the fact that we are interpenetrating, that we are in a dance together.
Right, but if she had recently killed your oldest child.
then I think part of my personal, if she had done what? Killed mine or hers? Well, then personalization includes straight talk. Straight talk, straight feedback. So if personalization shouldn't leave out straight feedback, if personalization gets too butterfly-y, butterfly's fine, but straight feedback, straight, concrete, direct, loving feedback. This is just, I mean, whatever she did, I don't know what she did. This was not okay. I'm not going to see you. I'm not going to see you again if you do this again, Laura. Because, you know, my time's valuable. It's not more any more valuable than yours, but your time's valuable too. So I'm not going to do this. Direct feedback. Personalization should not be this kind of religious stuff. You know what I mean? When I say religious, I mean sweet stuff. Sweet stuff, right? Part of our being in this dance together means that when she steps on my toes, I'm going to go, ow! That's right? That's a good question. Good question. And now it's time to do the next part of our dance. And it's Laura's turn.